Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, get psyched with the bloggers at this year's Republika in Berlin.
We do planning for things that would make the state nervous, and that's fun. Yes, we actually enjoy it. That's a good cat and mouse game.
More on that in a moment. We'll also be hearing from the Internet of Things and why this vision of the future might be the only way to preserve the way we've been living in the past. And researchers in the UK plumb the depths of London's underground network for the first major study into data mining. All that and more right here on Spectrum. Well, with all the bloggers, techies and thinkers leaving, the German capital Berlin should now be recovering from Republika 2012. The three-day international bloggers convention has grown into one of the most important events in the blogging calendar. But it's not only a chance for those in the know to get together and stroke their chins, it's also a chance for think tankers, activists and people from more traditional media to talk about current political situations. And a major focus at this year's Republika was internet censorship, of course, and the events in the Middle East. DW's Naomi Conrad was there.
The internet's down at the International Bloggers Conference Republika in Berlin, but no one seems particularly fussed. Some 4,000 bloggers, online activists and internet techies are milling around. Some are heading towards one of the seven stages to events such as Planet Hackers or Building a Beta World. Others are calmly typing away on their iPads or smartphones. Many of them, after all, are used to not being able to access the internet at all times. Arash Abadpour's blog is blocked in Iran, but getting around government online censorship can be exhilarating, says Abadpour, who's based in the US.
It's very much like you're in a prison and you want to just beat your, you know, prison master. You just want to do things that they don't want you to do. You just want to make them nervous. Like, we do planning for things that would make the state nervous, and that's fun. Yes, we actually enjoy it. That's a good cat and mouse game. It's enjoyable, I would say that.
Marcus Lemmer is also accustomed to repression by the state online, but for him, it's not a game. The 28-year-old Ethiopian blogger is scared. Although he doesn't blog about politics, his sister has begged him to stop because she's terrified that something might happen to him. A friend of his, the well-known Ethiopian journalist and blogger Eskinder Niga, is in prison, and another friend has just left the country.
There is a general fear on the blog sphere, especially with bloggers. I would say the self-censorship is a bit less sensitive in diaspora bloggers outside, because they have relatively more freedom to say things. But yeah, as you can imagine, it's very risky business there. The information flow is very limited, and then you don't know who end up already in prison right now when I'm talking to you.
Lemmer, who works as a computer scientist, says the Ethiopian government has cracked down on online activism ever since the country's disputed elections of 2005. Now, after the uprisings in the Arab world, censorship has got worse, Lemmer says. Critical blogs are often blocked, and there's a nationwide ban on using Skype. The social media site Facebook hasn't been blocked, making it the most popular site in Ethiopia, but that could easily change. The Ethiopian government is the sole internet service provider.
It's very easy to control because the penetration is very small. So, like I told you, it's like around 600,000 people are on the internet. And then, I mean, it's pretty easy to monitor these people. It's very, very comprehensive kind of censorship.
At the end of 2010, there were just 20 bloggers in Ethiopia. Today, there are about 100, including several women, says Lemmer. He works for an international development organization, but he'd rather not say which one, as the organisation works with the government and he doesn't want his employer to know about his activism. In his free time, Lemmer organises events to persuade more young people to blog. At one event, he prefers not to say which one, the secret police turned up.
They approached us and they want to stop the whole event.
So you stopped the event?
No, actually we tried to confront them, and then they put their people in there. On the events to surveillance, to monitor, so publicly monitor the event. I mean, it would definitely have an effect because everybody knows that they are there, and you cannot really say what you want to say. So, yeah, but, you know, like they went that far.
And he thinks they might go further. But Lemmer is hopeful. He says as Ethiopia grows economically, more and more young people will join the net. But, he says, it's an uphill struggle. Most young bloggers depend on university internet facilities, which are often slow and overcrowded. Internet cafes do exist, but they're very expensive.
So, like, it costs around 12 birr, which is a bit less from $1
and an hour. Lots of people are making $1 a day.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can finish your income in 1 hour internet access a day.
So activists have to come up with creative solutions. A friend of Lemma's translates his blog entries into one of the local languages, Amharic, and prints them off to give to his friends when he meets them for coffee. Because most young people in Ethiopia meet in cafes, that is, real cafes, not internet cafes.
Mouth-to-mouth information is probably it's going to continue in Ethiopia because that's actually how we interact. If you go to Addis and if you go to the cafes, it's full of people and chatting and talking. That probably also help the somehow promoting bloggers and the social media in Ethiopia as well.
As Lemma disappears into the crowd looking for new contacts, other bloggers at Republica are firing off tweets and blog entries on the last few panels they've seen, ranging from online gaming to digital diplomacy. Before joining the mass of people that's gathering outside to continue the debate at the end of conference party. Among them is US-Iranian blogger Arash Abadpour.
I had very good discussions with the Chinese jury member because the situation in the two countries is very similar and also connected because the governments are connected and a lot of the devices and a lot of technologies are being sent back and forth.
And net activists everywhere are showing they're just as connected as the governments, here and elsewhere, both online and offline.
Naomi Conrad reporting there from Republica in Berlin. Well, Republica is very much concerned with the digital links and interactions between people. But this year's event also had a look at the digital links between the machines and gadgets in our pockets and homes. You may have heard of the Internet of Things by now. As the so-called Council for the Internet of Things puts it, the IoT is being built as we speak, but hardly anyone's actually talking about it. That is, there's very little debate about what it will actually mean when your fridge starts ordering fresh milk without your knowing it, or your clothes start sending out positioning signals to a server somewhere where people might start doing all kinds of things with the data they're collecting about your very habits. There aren't many people who are against the idea, including data protection bodies in Europe and elsewhere. But Martin Spindler is an advocate, an IoT strategy consultant who spoke at Republica in Berlin. And when I spoke to him, I asked him first why he thought perhaps everyone was so scared about the Internet of Things.
I guess it's the same fear as about the cybernetics of old. It's fear of loss of control and having machines govern your life.
So this idea of the robots taking over, maybe?
Probably. And we're in Europe, after all, so we're constantly living with fears of privacy violations. And if you look at the current European Union consultation, it seems very much so that privacy concerns overrule almost all positive aspects that the Internet of Things could bring about.
So you're hinting there at an overbearing stance from the European Union that's against the Internet of Things.
Possibly, yes.
So give us an idea. What would it mean? What will it mean in practical terms? Is our clothing really going to be sending out positioning signals as we walk through town, the fridge ordering milk without our knowing about it?
I think the most obvious example is car sharing, for instance. I have an app on my smartphone which tells me exactly where the nearest car is that I could just walk up to, hold a card against it, and right away.
That's sort of like the technology that Deutsche Bahn has been using for some time with its bicycle sharing.
Exactly. Also, unfortunately, Deutsche Bahn is going back to a stations model for economic reasons. But I'm quite encouraged to have a get-in-anywhere, drop-it-off-anywhere model for car sharing, because that really makes the model viable for everyday users.
One other benefit that people do talk about or are starting to talk about is having these sensors, like what we do talk about when we talk about the Internet of Things, these radio frequency transmitters or identification devices, the RFIDs, that they could be built into, for instance, care homes, and could one of the applications could be that they could sense the quality of air in a care home, and that could be then the information could be sent to carers and who are looking after a certain person to make sure that they're okay. That's obviously a clear benefit, I think, but there is also the threat with applications like this, and very much the sense that this technology could be hijacked by businesses. Who do you think is going to benefit most from this sort of technology? And is there that threat?
I think that's impossible to answer, because how could I answer that? Of course, there's always the risk of the technical implementation being monopolized and then a big business extracting monopoly rent. But I think we have the European Union, which has gotten incredibly good at hindering businesses at that.
But I mean, if you look at something like Facebook or Twitter, or just companies, when you go into a shop asking you for your postcode, they're all collecting all this massive data. And it's not only in Europe, of course. This data can be sold internationally now. The world is truly globalized. Yeah. So there are precedents.
Of course, but the question then is not why that data, but what is being done with that data. And of course, you could think about prohibiting, for instance, recontextualization of certain data for specific purposes. I'd very much like, for instance, that German social security agencies have not access to my smart metering data or my energy consumption profile, that law enforcement may not proactively search for profiles in energy consumption, because it might hint at a crime being perpetrated. But that's not a function of the data that is being collected and stored. That's a function of how that data is being used. I don't think we should now argue against the data being stored and collected at all, because then we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Then we can't materialize the benefits that could be.
So what is the future then with the Internet of Things for you? I mean, can we really not live without it? Or is it just a case of this, there being the technology, and so we might as well walk down this road?
You can't have a green energy system without smart grids. It's as simple as that. You don't have intelligence in the grid. If you don't have intelligent distribution of the energy, you don't have intelligent use of the energy, you're not going to achieve either EU 2020, which posits that by 2020, which is 8 years from now, you've got to have at least 20% of electricity coming out of renewable sources, and you're certainly not going to achieve the 2050 goals of the European Union.
So essentially, the chips are the only are the conduit for what we really must be doing in order to survive as a species.
I think if we want to live at the level we're living now, it depends on a better distribution of the resources we have. Chips are a perfect tool for that, because they drive efficiency.
Martin Spindler, strategy consultant and advocate of the Internet of Things, speaking to me after his appearance at this year's Republica conference in Berlin. Well, it's now time for a look at some of the other things that have been making SciTech news over the last week with Andre Leslie.
Scientists in Australia say a new fossil discovery in the southeast of the country suggests its dinosaurs were cosmopolitan globetrotters, unlike the unique animals that inhabit Australia today, like koalas and kangaroos. Paleontologist Eric Fitzgerald says that an ankle bone fossil found near Melbourne indicates that meat-eating dinosaurs, known as ceratosaurs, lived in what is now Australia about 125 million years ago. And that means Australia was also home to the world's better-known predators like tyrannosaurs and allosaurs, which were found around the planet. The discovery is said to add to our understanding of dinosaurs in eastern Gondwana, the continent which broke into Australia, Antarctica and India between 80 and 130 million years ago. A super full and extra bright moon dazzled the night skies over the weekend of the 5th and 6th of May as the lunar body swept along the low point of its elliptical orbit around the Earth. The so-called lunar perigee brings the moon about 50,000 kilometres closer to the Earth than when it's at its furthest point of its oval orbit. when a full moon coincides with the low point, as it did overnight from Saturday to Sunday, it appears especially bright and large, with observers often able to make out craters and other lunar features in clearer detail than they normally can. Super full perigee moons occur about once a year. A study of people with blonde hair on Solomon Islands in Melanesia in the Pacific suggests that they evolved their striking blonde trait independently of people in Europe, refuting the otherwise held idea that blonde hair was introduced by European settlers. About 5 to 10% of people from Melanesia have naturally blonde hair, the highest prevalence outside Europe. But people from the region also have the darkest skin pigmentation outside Africa. Carlos Bustamante, a geneticist at Stanford University School of Medicine and a senior co-author of the study, says blonde hair has clearly evolved twice in the world. According to the new research, the blonde hair of some Solomon Islanders results from a unique gene mutation not shared by blonde Europeans. Researchers at the University of Leeds in the UK have used a type of bacterium which eats iron to create a surface of magnets similar to those found in traditional hard drives and wiring. As the bacterium ingests the iron, it creates tiny magnets within itself, and it's raising the question whether this magnet-making bacteria could be used to one day build computers with larger hard drives and speedier connections. The researchers from Leeds University and Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology are trying to understand how the proteins inside the bacteria collect, shape, and position these nanomagnets inside their cells and are starting to replicate the behaviour outside the bacteria. They now hope to develop a way to create cheaper, more environmentally friendly electronics of the future.
Andre Leslie there with the news. And don't forget, you can always keep right up to scratch with things at dw.de, or you can always hear the programme again at dw.de/spectrum. You can get the podcast there too.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The era of big data has transformed the way that businesses gather information about their customers, the way governments assess the needs of their citizens, and has also led to whole new areas of scientific research. Perhaps the best-known example of so-called data mining is Google Flu Trends, which has shown some success in tracking the spread of flu epidemics by analysing online searches, or at least that's how Google sees it. They think they've had some success in that anyway. Well, in the first study of its kind, researchers in Cambridge and London have looked at data generated by commuter journeys on the London Underground, and they hope it will tell us a few new things about the British capital city, its residents and their habits. From London, Robin Powell reports.
Last year, the London Underground carried over 1.1 billion passengers, the highest number ever. More and more people are using the tube, as it's known, and the vast majority use contactless travel cards, called Oyster cards, beeping through the turnstiles at each end of their journey. Now, each Oyster card has a unique anonymised number, which means every one of those journeys is logged and stored on the Transport for London servers. For Daniela Ketcher at the University of Cambridge Computer Lab, this data is a goldmine.
We took 1 month of transportation data from the underground, 76 million journeys done by Londoners, and then we compare with the census data, in particular it's called Index of Multiple Deprivation.
In a paper to be presented at a conference in June, Ketcher and his colleagues suggest that the data taken from these millions of underground journeys reveal things about different communities in London, rich and poor, that hadn't been proved on this scale before.
One of the most interesting aspects was that what if we differentiate well-off areas from deprived areas? What is going to happen? And what we found is that deprived areas are visited only by people who live in deprived areas, whereas well-off areas are visited by everyone. So there is some social segregation going on for people living in deprived areas.
That result might have been expected from what we already know about movement in cities, says sociologist David Byrne from the University of Durham. But the method is new.
Actually, what they're saying isn't terribly surprising. It would work even more strongly in many of Britain's provincial cities. What is interesting is the way they've thought about using this kind of electronic data and data mining.
Ketcher says that his technique lets researchers and policymakers observe changes in the social makeup of the city far quicker than ever before.
One of the things you can do with this kind of data, you can measure changes at a finer temporal level. So before you had to wait 5 years, 6 years to have the census data to understand the social deprivation in an area. Now you can track changes in a matter of 1 month, 2 months, 6 months.
But can we really use lists of journeys taken by Londoners to answer complex social questions about well-being in the city? For a start, there are whole sections of the population that aren't covered by Ketcher's database. People who take the bus, for example. Byrne says this is a serious omission.
There are big chunks of London which are rather poorly served by the tube system. So a lot of East London, and in particularly South London. And these tend to be rather more working class areas. So they don't have the full set of data. Now, the authors are perfectly clear about this. I mean, they're absolutely honest about the limitations of their data. But I think it's quite an important point.
Philippe Roda from the city's research hub at the London School of Economics comments that the connection between how people move around a city and social deprivation is far from straightforward.
That in itself is a big social science question. And there have been various attempts to link whether or not the amount of being connected with other human beings in the city and beyond is important to be economically active and successful.
Ketcher agrees that the research his team has done is a first step.
I wouldn't tailor policies around these results, but definitely at the conclusion of these studies that you can look at this data, we are going towards the right direction, and maybe we need to integrate different data sources, and that's exactly what we are doing now.
Adding sources like social media to gauge well-being more directly is another big data challenge that lies ahead. Experts agree, though, that data mining represents a huge opportunity for social sciences. In fact, in the UK, there's been much debate over whether the 10-year national census, which still is based on responses to questionnaires sent out in the post, should be replaced by an analysis of information already held by the government and other organisations. The data mining techniques pioneered by scientists like Ketcher show that future may not be so far away. Robin Powell for DW, London.
It's funny how quickly technology can become outdated or even out of favour completely. Just in the past week, Japan shut down its last remaining nuclear reactor as part of its efforts to build what it hopes will be a safe energy future. The nuclear disaster at Fukushima in 2011 sparked a new debate about safety issues in the nuclear industry around the world and even got Germany to pledge its own withdrawal. France, however, was one of a handful of countries that said it was sticking with nuclear. But there's a growing movement from within now. Nuclear nomads, as they're known in France, are contractors who work in radioactive areas of nuclear plants. Around the world, these workers are supposed to have the same safety conditions, but instead, they're often underpaid for the dirty work they do and often operate in dangerous conditions. Nuclear nomads in France have now formed an association, and some are even suing over alleged workplace violations. Dagmar Breitenbach has this report by Susanna Krause.
In his Paris office, attorney Cédric de Romanet leafs through the thick file of one of his clients, Christian Véronneau. For 25 years, Véronneau worked in decontamination at nuclear power plants. Today, he suffers from advanced lung cancer. A portion of his lungs has already been removed. In the summer of 2009, his illness was legally recognized as work-related. Now he's suing his employer for allegedly not protecting him enough from the radioactivity he says caused his cancer. Romanet, who specializes in environmental poisoning, says this is a first for France.
La spécificité du cas de Monsieur Véronneau.
Christian Véronneau belongs to a small group of maintenance engineers that can be described as forced labor. They're not paid by operators of the French nuclear plants like the energy giant EDF, but rather by subcontractors. EDF decided to stop putting its own staff in the more highly radioactive areas of the plants, and now passes along this job to the contractors. And EDF has its reasons for this, although I'm not sure what they are.
Que je ne connais pas, mais que je subodore.
reasons that EDF apparently doesn't want to make public. Written requests for information have remained unanswered. The first law requiring protection from radioactivity for workers in nuclear power plants was passed in 1967. As of today, European regulations allow for atomic workers to be exposed to a maximum of 20 millisieverts per year. Romane explains why workers believe this maximum limit hasn't worked out.
Et effectivement, malheureusement, au lieu de postuler le fait qu'il...
Unfortunately, it's the case that in the specialized field of nuclear energy, the employers, instead of seeking to minimize radioactive exposure to their employees, rather expect that the workers will be exposed to that given amount, because they think that workers exposed to the limit are not in danger. But as the record shows for Christian Véronneau, that's not the case.
L'exemple de Monsieur Véronneau prouve le contraire.
In the northern French port city of Le Havre, Philippe Billard is welcoming two colleagues to the small office of a local clubhouse. Like Christian Véronneau, the three worked for many years as maintenance engineers for a subcontractor of nuclear power plant operator EDF. In 2008, they founded an association for nuclear power workers. Now they're meeting to figure out how best to support their colleague in his legal battle.
Et puis, il faut absolument que dans ce dossier-là,
We simply must win this lawsuit. That would force our employers to do more prevention and improve safety standards. And if Christian Véronneau wins, maybe the politicians will realize what a risky industry the nuclear sector represents. The industry really needs to invest the bulk of its profits into better safety at the workplace and have robots to do the most dangerous work.
Subcontractors carry out 80% of yearly maintenance at French nuclear plants. The subcontractors are always on the go, under time pressure, and earn very little. The base income is 1,400 euros before taxes per month. Around 30,000 nuclear nomads, as they call themselves, work in France. Dominique Samson is one of them. During routine duties 4.5 years ago, the welder was contaminated by radiation. He claims that his employer failed to provide adequate safety equipment and is now demanding, in vain, that the accident be declared a workplace accident.
Pendant 3 jours, on m'a fourni un papier.
For the first 3 days after the accident, under orders from above, I had to give a wide berth to all radioactivity measuring equipment at the nuclear plant, you know, so their alarms wouldn't go off. Well, you could say, based on the dose of radioactivity that we get, we're like mini nuke plants. We just don't produce any electricity.
Only a few nuclear power plant workers dare to go public with their stories, says sociologist Anite Beaumoni. Since the end of the 1980s, she has been researching the working conditions of nuclear safety workers. The nuclear nomads are virtually invisible, and their medical care is substandard, she says. Subcontractors are also used in Japan, Germany, and Sweden, Thébault-Moni says. In France, subcontractors are outsourcing to further subcontractors to such a degree that environmental and nuclear safety agencies have apparently taken notice and are moving to limit this. Most disturbing, according to Thébault-Moni, is that often there's a gap between the work listed in the contract, including that which the maintenance engineers say is necessary, and that which doesn't get done due to lack of time.
La multiplication des incidents.
That's why there are always disturbances, as they're officially called. I call them accidents. In light of the frequency of disturbances in French nuclear plants, I fear that someday one of these disturbances could become a nuclear disaster.
Un incident qui tournerait à l'accident majeur.
Sociologist Annie Thébault-Moni, ending that report by Susanna Kölzer and Dagmar Breitenbach. And that's also just about all for another week from Spectrum. Don't forget to check out the web, of course, at dw.de/spectrum. Our studio tech this week was Christoph Gruver. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Thanks for listening. Until next time, bye for now.